This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Of the good things that happen in childhood, undoubtedly one of the best is being read to. Remember the pleasure. Tucked up in bed, ready to go to sleep, but not before the bedtime story, one chapter at a time. Or just one more. We can't leave it there. No, wait for tomorrow. There'll be another chapter tomorrow. It never changes, really. The same pleasure, the same anticipation, awaits us in adulthood as we bury ourselves in an engaging novel. We watch the plot develop. We wonder what's going to happen. We eagerly anticipate the moment when we can curl up with the book again and start another chapter. This is all quite understandable. We immerse ourselves in stories because we need a narrative in our lives, and this narrative usually follows a clear pattern in which things happen in sequence. One thing leads to another. There are beginnings and outcomes. A story that goes round and round and never gets anywhere may be entertaining in its way. Proust, after all, was a bit like that. But more usually, we want a story that makes us ask ourselves, what's going to happen next? Anticipation is the salt that can make the literary dish so tasty. Storytellers have always understood that this is the way we want our stories to be. Some have understood it particularly well, and Charles Dickens was one of these. Many of his books were serial novels. He wrote them in parts, in episodes, that were then released to his waiting public. Each chapter was separately bound and consisted of 32 pages of the text of the novel, along with a number of advertisements. It seemed that this suited everyone. Publishers were able to sell lots of copies, authors were able to speak to a much wider readership, and people who could not easily afford the cost of a whole book, and books were expensive then, could nonetheless pay the price of the monthly chapter. Later on, he began to write shorter chapters and to use newspapers for the publication of episodes. That made the stories even more accessible and cheaper for the reader too. And it worked, dramatically well. Imagine the scene at New York Harbour, where, we are told, people shouted to the incoming ship carrying the latest episode of The Old Curiosity Shop, "Is Little Nell dead?" Of course, one can see contemporary parallels for that. The eagerness with which young people queued up, sometimes overnight, for the release of the latest episode in the Harry Potter saga was much the same thing. And the same is true of people's eager anticipation of developments in a television series. Which of the characters is going to be killed in battle? Who will get Spanish flu? Interest in questions of this nature is not a purely modern phenomenon. It's exactly what happened with Dickens. But writing a serial is a very particular art and presents challenges that are very different from those faced by the author of a conventional novel, one published in complete form after the author has finished writing it. Insofar as there is a typical structure for a conventional novel, it tends to be Act 1, the setting of the scene and the introduction of the characters. Act 2, the dilemma or issue that forms the essence of the novel. And Act 3, its resolution. That, of course, is a considerable simplification, and there are plenty of novels that do not follow that pattern, but many do. Within that structure, there's room for a great deal of meandering. A chapter does not necessarily need to advance the plot. It can be about something altogether distant from the main thrust of the novel. It may be reflective, for example, or it may involve a flashback to some earlier matter. The novelist usually has time to wander off on an excursus, and the reader will understand this. Indeed, the reader may very much enjoy a break, a palate refresher between the chapters that actually advances the plot. Significantly, a chapter in this conventional structure need not end with anything like a cliffhanger. It can end in any way the author likes. Now, it's perfectly possible to take a conventional novel and chop it up into however many parts you wish and to publish it part by part in a newspaper or magazine. In one respect, the novel will become a serial novel by virtue of its serialization. But in an important sense, it will simply remain an ordinary novel that has been chopped up into bits. And that will show, because each section will not have the characteristic features of the real serial novel, somehow it will sound different. What does that mean? Well, I might have had difficulty in explaining that difference until I myself became a serial novelist. There's no better way of learning how something's done, either the painting of a picture or the writing of a novel or even the making of a cake, than doing it yourself. By doing something, you discover the technical challenges and the way in which those challenges are met. Like most people, I hadn't given this notion of writing in serial form much thought until I found myself in California some years back and was invited by the novelist Amy Tan to a party in her house just outside San Francisco. The party was attended by a group of writers who lived in the vicinity, including Armistead Maupin, the author of the very popular Tales of the City series. This was a modern series that had been published in the San Francisco Chronicle and had become popular not only with readers of that newspaper, but with those who read the stories when they were later published in book form. I had a conversation with Armistead, who remarked that he found writing serial novels quite an undertaking. When I returned to Scotland, I was asked by the editor of a newspaper to write an article about my American tour, and I mentioned this conversation. But I also remarked that it was a pity that newspapers no longer published Dickensian serials. This drew an invitation to lunch from the editor of another newspaper, Ian Martin of The Scotsman. "You're on," said Ian, "write us a serial." In a fit of bravado, I agreed, and found myself committed to writing a novel that would be published in daily chapters, 110 in all. Because of the timescale involved, these chapters would have to be published more or less as I wrote them, or perhaps only a week or two afterwards. This meant I would not simply be breaking up something that had already been written. It would be hand-to-mouth, or to use another metaphor, seat-of-the-pants stuff. I had no real idea how to do it. Of course, had I thought about it, all the answers were there in Dickens, and could be worked out by analysing the approach that he took. It did not occur to me to consult the master, and so I launched myself into the exercise, and thus only discovered in retrospect the debt that I and all other serial novelists owe to that great 19th-century exponent of the writer's art. I was working on a different scale. My chapters in the series I started for The Scotsman, 44 Scotland Street, and also in the series I subsequently wrote for The Daily Telegraph, were only 1,100 words long. Dickens' chapters are often 12 times that length. But even within that reduced scale, the same rules apply. Every chapter must have at least one major event or disclosure. This is usually set up quite near the beginning. The reader is drawn into an engagement with the issue, and then, at the end of the chapter, we're left with a simple question in our mind: what's going to happen next? Here's an example from Great Expectations. Pip is being sent off to the mysterious Miss Havisham's. Our curiosity is aroused about this, and the chapter is crafted accordingly.
"Goodbye, Joe."
"God bless you, Pip, old chap."
I had never parted from him before, and what with my feelings and with soap suds, I could at first see no stars from the chaise cart. But they twinkled out, one by one, without throwing any light on the questions why on earth I was going to play at Miss Havisham's, and what on earth I was expected to play at.
So there may be a standard cliffhanger, the sort of chapter ending where one of the characters is, in fact, left hanging on to a cliff and in danger of falling. Dickens is not above using such methods, and I found myself following him in this, sometimes in a way that could almost flirt with parody. In the third volume of my Corduroy Mansions series, A Conspiracy of Friends, I take a group of MPs on a visit to the CERN Particle Accelerator in Switzerland. This group includes the odious Oedipus Snark, widely considered to be the only truly unpleasant Liberal Democrat MP. The politicians are shown round the accelerator tunnel and then return to the control room, where the director demonstrates the machine by turning it on. And it's at this point that somebody pipes up, "Has anyone seen Mr. Snark?" Yes, that's outrageous, and is every bit as bad as leaving a character hanging on to a cliff edge with his fingernails. But I believe it works, just. If you know somebody's been left behind in a particle accelerator, then can you really fail to read the next chapter? Cliffhangers, of course, have to be used sparingly, or the whole novel will have a very breathless feel to it and the cliffhangers themselves will become risible. In fact, if one looks through Dickens, one's struck by something rather surprising. A very large number of the chapters end not with some dramatic, possibly hazardous scene, but with the narrator going to sleep. I think that he must have found this a useful device. Going to sleep clearly signals a pause in the narrative, and it also allows for dreams that say something about what went before or what is to come. Great Expectations again, the end of chapter 10. I had sadly broken sleep when I got to bed, through thinking of the strange man taking aim at me with his invisible gun, and of the guiltily coarse and common thing it was to be on secret terms with conspiracy and convicts. And then the end of chapter 18. I put my light out and crept into bed, and it was an uneasy bed now, and I never slept the old sound sleep in it any more. Indeed not, for at the end of chapter 31, miserably I went to bed after all, and miserably thought of Estella, and miserably dreamed that my expectations were all cancelled. David Copperfield seems to have had better dreams than Pip. Here's the end of chapter 19, with David going to sleep in an inn.
I found my new room a great improvement on my old one, it not being at all musty, and having an immense four-poster bedstead in it, which was soon quite a little landed estate. Here, among pillows enough for six, I soon fell asleep in a blissful condition, and dreamed of ancient Rome, Steerforth, and friendship, until the early morning coaches rumbling out of the archway underneath made me dream of thunder and the gods.
It's a feature of Dickens' novels that the chapters often end on a note of reflection rather than unambiguous suspense or uncertainty. This is interesting, as the effect is to give some resolution, not the resolution that comes with the solution to a problem or difficulty, but that which flows from a calm appraisal of where one is. What he's doing is to underline the effect of the events of the chapter, and this has the interesting result of making us, the readers, want to know more, particularly in those novels such as David Copperfield, where the narrative is in the first person. The end of so many chapters in that book seems to be a taking aside of the reader by the narrator. So, he says, this is where we are, and this is what I thought of my situation. It has the air of an imparted confidence, a slight feeling of confessional. And that, of course, binds reader to narrator, immerses us further in the story. Here's David Copperfield at the end of a chapter.
Miss Mills and her journal were my sole consolation at this period. To see her, who had seen Dora but a little while before, to trace the initial letter of Dora's name through her sympathetic pages, to be made more and more miserable by her, were my only comforts. I felt as if I had been living in a palace of cards which had tumbled down, leaving only Miss Mills and me among the ruin, as if some grim enchanter had drawn a magic circle round the innocent goddess of my heart, which nothing indeed but those same strong pinions, capable of carrying so many people over so much, would enable me to enter.
There's one particular respect in which I found that, even using Dickens as the serial novelist's benchmark, I fail to meet the standard he sets. The plots of a Dickens novel are perfect in the way in which they unfold. He knew what was going to happen and how it would happen. I don't know whether he changed his mind as he went along. The Dickens scholars will no doubt be able to tell us that. But his plots do not appear to vacillate in any way. By contrast, I found that by publishing each chapter very shortly after I've written it, I may commit to a development that I later regret, and am then unable to change what happened, because the relevant part has already been published in the newspaper. So a character may enter the plot and then, because I've lost interest in him or her, have to disappear. I also find that I'm susceptible to suggestions from readers, who often write in with their views as to what might happen in future chapters. If the readers take against a character in a big way, then that particular figure has very little chance in a serial novel. There are plenty of cliffs over which literary characters can fall. Or waterfalls, too. Remember Holmes and those fateful falls? But that's another story altogether.